Flashman and the Redskins by George MacDonald Fraser. Continued. Cassette 11, side 2.
Now, two things I must make clear. First, that I'd not merely been viewing the stirring scene, but considering keenly which way salvation lay, and deciding to lie low. I was wearing 4 feet of timber across my neck, you see, with my hands bound to it, to say nothing of being painfully gagged, and while my feet were free, I felt I'd be a trifle conspicuous if I lit out from cover. And where to, anyway? Secondly, my memory, while acute for what I hear and see and feel in the heat of battle, is usually at fault where time is concerned. I'm not alone in that. Any soldier will tell you that 5 minutes fighting can seem like an hour, or t'other way round. From the sound of the first shot, I would guess that perhaps 20 minutes had passed, and now the sound of firing was decidedly fainter. When across the clearing, walking blanket woman came running. She'd pushed past me and disappeared, you remember, and here she was again, excited as all get-out.
"They are killing your pony soldiers, i.e.," cries the bloodthirsty Biddy. "They are driving them back on the river everywhere they kill them, ee-hees. Soon all will be dead."
She was rummaging in a corner of the teepee, and tell me if she didn't come up with a most ugly-looking hatchet and a long, thin knife, which she tested on the ball of her thumb, grunting with satisfaction. She was going to join in the fun, no doubt to avenge her brother. And then she stopped and looked at me, and might have battled out of the saucy little face, and I could read thoughts as clear as if she'd spoken. "Drat," she said, "there's this great idiot to look after me all over a heap to help the remains. How tiresome. Oh, well, some got to mind, I suppose. Not though, if I look after him permanently, I can go with the conscience. On the other hand, jacket will be annoyed at the chid of his little Acacia. Haven't seen good flaying, dismembering, or myself matter, but I would like to join them up yonder." It was such a winsome the first two, as the expressions chased one another across it, my gorge road. She was eyeing me doubtfully, thoughtfully, angrily, determinedly. And I was about to bolt headlong, yoke or not, when above the distant firing came another sound, so faint that for instance I thought imagination. Yet it was quite close at hand, across the river. She had two words stuck still, strain our ears. It was the tiniest murmur at first, and then drift, as of a moose pipe, far, far away. And while I'm well aware that the 7th Cavalry Band was not present at Little Bon, I know what I heard, and all I can say that some troop had a penny whistle and was blowing it. For somewhere beyond the river, on high bluffs, a bare mile away, was sounding me with Garin. Walking blanket woman beside me an instant, we both stood staring over the trees. Bluffs empty. And then there was a movement, other about, and then another tiny object just off the skyline, slowly coming into view. Horsemen, and another foremost carrying a door, and then a file of troopers, and I'd make out the shapes of fatigue hats, 10, 20, 30 riders. As they rode at the walk, popping was thinner, and I found the woods running through my head that the 8th Hussars had swept out. "Art so stout have got us fame, for soon is known from whence we came. Where'er we go, they dread the name of Garry Owen in Gory." The piping stopped, and I had the shaft and fainter trees. They had halted, and in the little knot of men round the Guido, I caught a glint. Field glasses sweeping the valley. Cusser had come to Little Bighorn. Perhaps I'm a better soldier than I care to think, for I know what I thought in that moment. My first concern should have been how the blade had across to them, but possibly as it was a long, deep way, and there was a young lady beside me at least toying with the notion, putting a nut point in my ear and pushing. It's academic. The instinctive order that I would have followed across that river was, "Retire, and don't tarry on the way. Get out, laddie fool, get out fast while there's still time." He didn't have so. Even watched, I saw a tiny figure with hand raised, and went lay the faint fall of 410, and coming on along the bluffs, and wheeling down at the lee, and beyond the bluff there left a spatter of shooting. Down the steep came a handful of Sioux at the run, and after them a party of re-scouts, little puffs of smoke jetting after the fugitives. There were yells of alarm from far up the river, closer than the distant popping of the first fight, which had faded into the distance. A bugle sounded on the bluffs, and the first troop was coming down the coulee. Greys, and I thought I could make out Smith at their head. Had lunch with your wife and Libby Custer on the far west recently, was the ridiculous thought that went through my mind. And behind them there came a sorrel troop. Why, that would be Tom Custer, who'd wept at that ghastly play in New York. And there, by God, at the head of the column was the great man himself. I could see the flash of the red scarf on his breast, and I almost burst my gag, willing him to stop and turn, for he was doing a cardigan, if ever a man did, and he couldn't see it. The clamour in the trees upstream was rising now. I thought I could hear pony hooves, and from the left, along the water's edge, came a mounted brave, yelling in alarm, waving his rifle above his head, and after him two more, Cheyenne, as I live, all a-bristle with eagle feathers and white bars of paint. The girl gasped beside me, and I turned to look at her, and she at me. And what I tell you is strictest true. I looked at her with a question in my eyes. Flashy's eyes, you know. And I put every ounce of noble mute appeal into them that I knew how. And that's considerable. God knows I've been looking at women all my life. Ardent, loving, lustful, worshipful, respectful, mocking, charming, and gallant as Gadfrey. And while I've had a few clips on the ear and knees in the crotch, more often than not it has worked. I looked at her now, giving her the full benefit, the sweet little soul, and like all the rest, she succumbed. As I say, it's true, and here I am, and I can't explain it. Perhaps it's the whiskers, or the 6'2" and broad shoulders, or just my style. But she looked at me, and her lids lowered, and she glanced across the river where the troopers were riding down the coulee, and then back at me. This girl whose brother had been killed by my people only a few days back. I can't describe the look in her eyes, frowning, reluctant, hesitant, almost resigned. She couldn't help herself, you see, the dear child. Then she sighed, lifted the knife, and cut the thongs, securing my hands to the yoke.
"Go on, then," says she, "you poor old man."
Well, I couldn't reply with my mouth full of gag, and by the time I'd torn it out, she'd gone, running off to the right with her hatchet and knife, God bless her. And I was cool enough to drain a bowl of water and chafe my wrists while I took in the lie of the land, because if I was to win across to Castro in safety, it was going to be a damn near-run thing, and I must settle my plan in shaved seconds and then go bull at a gate. To the right, my girl was nearing the trees, and there were a few Indians in sight, but a hell of a lot more behind by the sound of it, no doubt streaming down from the first fight to give the boy general a welcome. Three Cheyenne had appeared from the left, and knowing them, I doubted if they'd be the only ones. By God, Castro had picked a rare spot to make his entry. The three Cheyenne were close to the bank, perhaps 50 yards away on my left front, arguing busily with a couple of Indians on foot. They were pointing up towards the ford and doubtless remarking that the pony soldiers would shortly be crossing it and charging through the heart of the village. At that moment, out from between the teepees on my right, came the old singer leading a pony and yelling his head off.
"Go, go, Lakotas! See where the long knives come! The sun is on the hawk and the quarry! Hoo, hey! It's a good day to die!"
If I'd been the Cheyenne, I'd have spat in his eye. For one thing, they weren't Lakotas, and no doubt sensitive. But now was my moment. I looked across the river. The seventh were fairly pouring down the coulee as far as I could see, for the further they got down, the more they were obscured by the trees on the banks. The bugle was shrilling. Shots were cracking on my side of the river. The three Cheyenne were apparently fed up with arguing, for they were skirting upwards towards the ford, and my ancient, with his led pony, was hobbling in their direction, shouting to the two dismounted chaps to take his steed and good luck, boys. I took a deep breath and ran. The old fool never knew I was there until I was on the pony's back. It might have been 10 seconds, probably less, but time for me to realize that I was in such poor trim, what with my ordeal, aching limbs, too much tuck, booze and cigars, and general evil living, that if he and I had run a race, the old bugger would have won by yards. But he was looking ahead, yelling,
"Here, calf, bobtail, horse, mad wolf, here's a pony, climb aboard one of you fellows and smite the white faces and my blessing go with you,"
or words to that effect. I hauled myself onto the beast, grabbed the mane and dug in my heels. I know people were running somewhere to my right. The Cheyenne were trotting purposefully towards the ford. Shots were flying all along the river banks. And dead ahead of me, under the cottonwoods, was the ford leading to the coulee. Behind me, the dotard was yelling,
"Go on, Lakota, here is a brave heart. See how he flies to meet the long knives."
Apparently under the impression that I was one of the lads. The three Cheyenne were moving well, too, four of us going hell for leather, more or less in line abreast, three in paint and feathers, waving lances and guns, and one in white tie and tails, somewhat out of crease, Possibly they, too, thought that I belonged to the elect, for they didn't so much as spare me a glance as we converged on the ford. They were three good men, those. Again, I speak objectively, for they were going bald-headed against half a regiment, and they knew it. If the Indians put up statues, I reckon those three Cheyenne would be prime candidates. For if anyone turned the tide of greasy grass, they did. Mind you, I'm not saying that if Custer had got across the ford, he'd have had the battle won. I doubt it myself. He'd have got cut up either side, I reckon. But the first nails in his coffin were roan horse, calf, and bobtail horse, and possibly my humble self, for it was our appearance at the ford, I think, that checked his advance. I don't know, except that when my pony hit the shallows, with the three Cheyenne close behind, I lifted up mine eyes to the hills, and saw to my amazement that the troopers in the coulee were dismounting and letting fly with the carbines. Whether the three Cheyenne stopped or came on, I don't know, for I wasn't looking. There were shots buzzing like bees overhead as I scrambled up the bank, and not 20 yards away a Rees scout and a trooper were covering me with their carbines, and I was bawling, "Don't shoot, it's me, I'm white, hold your fire!" One did, t'other didn't, but he missed, thank God, and I was careering over the flat to the mouth of the coulee, hands raised and holding on with my aching knees, yelling to them not to shoot for any favour, and a knot of bewildered men was standing at gaze. There was E Troop Skidon, and as I half fell from my pony, there was Custer himself, all red scarf and campaign hat, carbine in hand. For a second he stared speechless, as well he might, then he said, "Good God!" quite distinctly, and I replied at the top of my voice, "Get out of it! Get out now! Up to the top and ride for it!" Somehow he found his tongue, and as God's my witness, the next thing he said was, "You're wearing evening clothes!" and looked beyond me across the river, doubtless to see if other dinner guests were arriving. "How in—" I seized him by the arm, preparing to yell some more until common sense told me the calm would serve better. "George," says I, "you must get out quickly, you know. Now, mount him up and retire as fast as you can. Back up this draw and onto the bluffs." "What do you mean?" cries he. "Retire? And where in creation have you come from? How the deuce—" "Doesn't matter. I tell you, get this command away from here, or you're all dead men. Look, George, there are more Indians than you've ever seen over yonder. They're beating tar out of someone upriver, and they'll do the same for you if you stay here."
"Why, that's Reno," cries he. "Have you seen him?"
"No, for Christ's sake, I haven't been within a mile of him. But it's my belief he beats. George, listen to me. You must get out now." "Tongues to my elbow. When he asked all over yonder, snappy. Thousands. Sue, Cheyenne, Mother's Honey, Lord of Barton, can't you see the size of their village?"
And in fury turned, took shot the swarming up to the ford from both directions, mounted Cheyenne among the trees downriver, now in sight, like trout darting through weed, but coming by hundreds, and from the trees upstream, misty rat musketry was me. Balls overhead, winding up the coulee, there were shouts command to a fight from above it. "March!" was cast.
"Fifth, E trooper to advance! Tom, with a trooper!"
Turned to bellow up the coulee.
"Captain Yates, we're going across. Sound!"
He swung himself to his saddle. Behind was the creak and jingle and shouting as the troopers took their beasts from us, and a scout of Custer's side putting across the river.
"He's right, Colonel, didn't I say? We go in there, we don't come out."
It might have been obvious to anyone who was stark mad, but Custer was red in the face and roaring. He swung his hat and yelled at me.
"Come on, flash forward, light brigade! Didn't I know you'd be in at the death?"
"Whose bloody death, infernal idiot?" I yelled back and cried,
"George, for God's sake, what are you about, sir?"
cried he angrily.
"Out!"
And at that moment he jerked back in his saddle. I saw the splash of crimson on his sleeve as his horse surged past me. He'd tumbled, he was too good a horseman for that. He reined in, and at that moment one of the Rees scouts by spun round, felt blood spouting from his neck. Shots working up the dust all about us. Horse screamed and thrashing. By George, that had been a regular volley, at least 30 rolls together, which you'd expect from Sages. Us, there were a perfect mob of them, was close to the fort, halting to bring up their pieces and those for another few. A silent clapping of them, arms raised to bird. I flung myself at as shots and arrows whizzed past. I came up to Custer, standing in his stirrups, blood running over his head.
"After carrying fire, Tom, Smith, move out with troops!"
sang in sense, pointing up the hillside away from the bluffs.
"Retire, out of range! Bugler, I, Captain Cochran, I'll be obliged if he and Miss Calhoun will hold the crest yard. You said on the top there, with the troops, go!"
He urged his beast up the coulee.
"Yates, we're down yonder!"
He pointed across the water, but already Yates' troops blazing away, and Smith and Tom Custer were rushing there at the north bank of the coulee, upwards towards the greasy grass slope that lay in the crest and the river. I was among them, clawing my way up the coulee side onto the rough hilly ground in the middle of a hasten car troopers of mount, but mostly leading their beasts.
I swung myself aboard one of led ponies, arguing blasphemously with its owner, who jogged over the hillside. Pots were still buzzing past, and was another draw across our front, which we scrambled, drawing rein as the bugle blared again. I had a moment to collect myself and look round. A bare 100 yards away at the foot of the slope, the trees were alive with hostiles, firing raggedly up at us. There were 3 troops on the slope round about where I was. When I looked up the hill, there were I and L troops skirmishing out in good order. Castor was sliding down from his pony, using one hand and his teeth to tie a handkerchief round his grazed wrist. I ran to him and jerked the ends tight. "Good man," he gasped, and looked about. I don't know if he saw what I already knew, although it was too late now. "Take a squint at my map and you'll see it. He'd come the wrong way." I ain't being clever, but if he'd done what I told him, he might have saved most of his command by withdrawing straight up Medicine Tail Coulee and making a stand on the high bluffs, where 5 troops could have held off an army. Or if he'd retired flat out, Calhoun and Kioff could certainly have saved their troops. By coming across to the greasy grass slope, he'd put his command out in the open, where the Red Sticks could skirmish up over good broken ground, and our only hope was to achieve the hill at the far end of the crest and make good a position there. And we might have done it too, if that red-jacketed bastard Gaul hadn't been an Indian in a million. That is, an Indian with an eye for ground, like Wellington. The little swine saw at once how we'd blundered, and exactly what he must do. It's a simple tactical thing, and for those of you who ain't sure what turning a flank means, it's a fair example. We had to make for the hill, with half the Sioux Nation coming up from the ford at our heels. If they'd simply pursued us straight, we'd likely have reached it. But Gaul saw that the crest between the bluffs and the hill was all important, and as soon as we were out on the greasy grass slope, he had his warriors pouring up the second coulee in droves, nicely under cover, until they could get high enough up to emerge all along the line of the second coulee, especially at the crest itself, where they could hit at I and L troops and be well above Custer's 3 other troops making for the hill. Smart Indian fighting the white man in the white man's way, and with overwhelming strength to make a go of it. In the meantime, his skirmishers coming up on us from the river were pressing us too hard to give Custer time to regroup for any kind of counterstroke. He couldn't charge downhill, for even if he'd scattered our pursuers, he'd have been stopped by the river with Kioff's folks stranded. All he could do was retire to the hill, with Kioff falling back the same way. Our fellows were all dismounted in 3 main groups across the slope, leading their horses and firing down at the Indians, who were swarming up through the folds and gullies, blazing away as they came. Curiously, I don't think we'd lost many men yet, but now troopers began to fall as the slugs and arrows came whistling out of the blue, and I saw the first example of something that was to happen horrid frequent on that slope in the next 15 minutes. A trooper kneeling with his reins over his arm, raving obscenely as he dug frenziedly with his knife at a spent case jammed in his carbine. That's what happens. Some factory expert don't test a weapon properly, and you pay for it out in the hill when the rim shears off and your gun's useless. "Tell Smith to close up with E-troop," yells Custer, and I saw the hostiles were up with Smith 50 yards below us in a murderous struggle of pistols and lances, hatchets and carbine butts. To our own front they were surging up, ducking and firing, and we were retreating, firing back. I stumbled over a little gully through a clump of thistles, fell on my face, heard the rattle within a foot of my ear, and there was a snake gliding under my nose into the dusty grass. I never even thought about him. "Give me a gun, for pity's sake," I yelped, and Custer flung away his jammed carbine and threw me one of his bulldog repeaters while he drew the other for himself. Christ, they were a bare 10 yards off, shrieking, painted faces and feathered heads racing towards me. I fired, and one fell sprawling at my feet. Guns were blasting all about me. Custer, he was cool, say that for him, was firing with one hand, while with his wounded one he was thrusting a packet of cartridges at me. I saw the lens of his field glasses splinter as a shot hit them. There were a dozen of us clawing our way backwards up out of a gully, firing frantically at the red mob pouring down the other bank. We broke and ran in a confusion of yelling, swearing men and rearing horses. Below, on the slope, a body of kneeling troopers with their sorrels behind them, Tom Custer's people, were firing revolver volleys at our pursuers, and behind me as I flew were shrieks of agony blending with the war whoops. "Steady!" roars Custer. There he was, shoving rounds into his bulldog and firing coolly, picking his men while the arrows whizzed round him. "Fall back in order! Close on, sea troop!" Beside him, a trooper with the guidon staggered an arrow between his shoulders. Custer wrenched the staff from him and plunged uphill. I scrambled up beside him, swearing pathetically as I fumbled shells into my revolver. And for a moment the firing died, and Yates was beside me, yelling something I couldn't hear as I staggered to my feet. We were in a long gully running from the hill top to the trees far down by the river. The slopes below me were littered with bodies, the blue of troopers among the Indians, and lower still, Indian attackers were bounding up the gully sides. The remnant of Smith's troop were reeling up the gully, turning and firing, loose horses among them, redskins racing in to grapple at close quarters. I heard the hideous "Hoon! Hoon!" as the clubs and hatchets swung and the knives went home, and the crash of army pistols firing point blank. Around me were what was left of Yates's troop, staggering figures streaked with dust and blood. Just down the slope, Tom Custer's fellows were at grips with a horde of painted, shrieking braves, slashing and clubbing at each other hand to hand. I struggled out of the gully. In its bed, a trooper was lying, screaming and plucking feebly at a lance buried in his side, two Indians dead beside him and a third still kicking. I looked back across the gully and saw the final death bearing down upon us. Across the upper slopes of the greasy grass they came, hundreds of running, painted figures, and on a pony among them that crimson leader, waving them on for the kill. Tom Custer's tattered remnant was breaking clear of a tangled melee of blue-shirted and red half-naked fighters, who still hacked and stabbed and shot at each other. Somewhere on the crest our new kiosk people must be struggling with the right wing of that Indian charge sweeping across the slope. In less than a minute they'd be on us. I turned sobbing to run for the hilltop, a bare 100 yards away, and even in that moment it crossed my mind, we've come a long way damn fast, for I'd no notion it was so close. We must have retreated a good mile from the ford where I'd ridden across with the Cheyenne just a moment ago. Custer was on his feet, reloading, looking this way and that. His hat was gone, his hand was caked, dried blood. There were about 40 troopers round him, firing past me down the hill. As I came up to them, an arrow shower fell among us. There were screams and groans and raging blasphemy. Yates was on the ground, trying to staunch blood pumping from a wound in his thigh. "Artery gone," I saw. Custer bent over him. "I'm sorry, old fellow," I heard him say. "I'm sorry. God bless all of you and have you in his keeping." There was a slow moment, one of those which you get in terrible times, as at the Balaclava battery, when everything seemed to happen at slow march, and the details are as clear and inevitable as day. Even the shots seemed slower and far off. I saw Yates fall back and put up a hand to his eyes like a man who's tired and ready for bed. Custer straightened up, breathing noisily, and cocked his bulldog. And I thought, you don't need to do that. It's British made and fires at one pressure. A trooper was crying out, "Oh, no, 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 it's a damn shame." And the F troop Guidon fell over on a wounded sergeant, and he pawed at it, wondering what it was, and frowned and tried to push its butt into the ground. On the crest behind them I saw a sudden tumult of movement and thought, "Ah, yes, those are mounted Sioux. By Jove, there are plenty of them, and tearing down like those Russians at Campbell's Highlanders. Lot of war bonnets and lance heads, and how hot the sun is, and me with no hat. Elspeth would have sent me indoors for one. Elspeth! Oh, hey, la Kodak, it's a good day to die. Kai, kai, you bloody liars," I screamed, and all was fast and furious again with a hellish din of drumming hooves and screams and war whoops and shots crashing like a dozen Gatlings altogether, the mounted horde charging on one side, and as I wheeled to flee, the solid mass of red devils on foot racing in like mad things, clubs and knives raised. And before I knew it, they were among us, and I went down in an inferno of dust and stamping feet and slashing weapons, with stinking bodies on top of me, and my right hand pumping the bulldog trigger while I gibbered in expectation of the agony of my death stroke. A moccasined foot smashed into my ribs. I rolled away and fired at a painted face, and it vanished, but whether I hit it or not, God knows, for directly behind it, Custer was falling on hands and knees. And whether I'd hit him, God knows again. He rocked back on his heels, blood coming out of his mouth, and toppled over. And I scrambled up and away, cannoning into a red body, hurling my empty bulldog at a leaping Indian, and closing with him. He had a saber of all things, and I closed my teeth in his wrist and heard him shriek as I got my hand on the hilt and began laying about me blindly. Indians and troopers were struggling all around me. A lance brushed before my face. I was aware of a rearing horse and its Indian rider grabbing for his club. I slashed him across the thigh and he pitched screaming from the saddle. I hurled myself at the beast's head and was dragged through the mass of yelling, stabbing, struggling men. 2 clear yards and I hauled myself across its back, righting myself as an Indian stumbled under its hooves, and then I was urging the pony up and away from that horror, over grassy ground that was carpeted with still and writhing bodies, and beyond it little knots of men fighting, soldiers with clubbed carbines being overwhelmed by waves of Sioux. But there was a guidon and a little cluster of blue shirts that still fired steadily. I rode for them, roaring for help, and they scrambled aside to let me through, and I tumbled out of the saddle into Keok's arms. "Where's the General!" he yelled, and I could only shake my head and point dumbly towards the carnage behind me, but it wasn't visible, and I saw that somehow I'd ridden over the crest on the far side from the river, and the crest itself was alive with Indians firing at us, rushing closer and firing again. Keok yelled above the din, "Sergeant Butler!" A ragged blue figure was beside him, gold chevrons smeared with blood and dust. "Ride out, see if you can find Major Reno. Tell him we're hemmed in and the General's dead." He shoved hard at Butler, who turned and slapped the neck of a bay horse that was lying among the troopers. It came up, whinnying at his touch, and as Butler grabbed the reins, he came face to face with me, and he must have seen me at Fort Lincoln, for he said, "Hello then, Colonel, long way from all scars, ain't we though?" Then he was up and away, head down, going hell for leather at the advancing Sioux, and thinks I, by God, it's that or nothing, and scramble on my own beast as the red tide flooded in amongst us. It was like Scarlet's charge, a mass of men, close-packed, contorted faces, white and red, all about me, carrying me and the horse, whether we would or no, and there was no time to think or do anything but swing my saber at every eagle feather in sight, screaming wildly as the mass of men disintegrated, and I dug in my heels and went in blind panic. As I fled, I lifted my head and gazed on such a scene as even I can hardly match from all my memories of bloody catastrophe. Until this moment, you'll agree, I'd had little time for careful thought or action. From the moment I'd crossed the ford and tried to reason with Custer, it had been one shot torn nightmare of struggle up the slope away from those hordes of red fiends, followed by the chaos when our retreat had been caught in the death grip between Gaul's charge and the mounted assault, led, I'm told, by Crazy Horse in person, over the very hill to which we'd been struggling for safety. Now, with Keok's troop being engulfed behind me, I was recrossing the crest, overlooking the whole greasy grass slope to the river at its foot. I wasn't there above an instant, but I'll never forget it. Below me, the hillside was covered with dead and dying, and with little clusters where shots still rang out, a few desperate wretches taking as many Sioux with them as they could. There were hundreds of figures running, riding, and some just walking across the slope, and they were all Indians. Most of them were hurrying across my front to the struggle still boiling just below the hilltop, where Custer's group were dying. There may have been a score of them, I can't tell, standing and lying and sprawling in a disordered mass, the pistols and carbines cracking, while the mounted wave of war bonnets and eagle feathers rode round and through and over them, the clubs and lances rising and falling to the yells of "Horn! Horn!" while Gaul's footmen grappled and stabbed and scalped at close quarters. There was no guidon flying, no ring of blue shoulder to shoulder, no buckskin figure with flowing locks and sabre. He was one of the still forms in that crawling melee. No, there was just a great hideous scrimmage of bodies, like a big side maw when the ball's well hidden. Only here it was not "off your side," but "hoon," and the crash of shots and flash of steel. That was how the 7th Cavalry ended. Bayete, 7th Cavalry. Elsewhere it was already over.
Far down to my left, a mob of Indians were shooting and stabbing and mutilating over a long cluster of blue forms. That would be Calhoun's troop. Straight ahead below me, to the right of the long gully, the cavalry dead lay thick where Yates and Tom Custer and Smith had died with their troops. But far down there was still a group mounted on sorrels, and I could see the puffs of smoke from their pistols. All this I took in during one long, horrified second. It couldn't have been longer, or I wouldn't be here. I doubt if I even checked stride, for one glance behind showed a dozen mounted braves and a score running, and they all had flashy in their sights. To the left and below, the slope was thick with the bloodthirsty bastards. All you can do is see where the enemy are thinnest and go like hell. I swerved right in full career, for there was a break of perhaps 10 yards and the mob surging up to join in the massacre of Custer's party. I went for it, saber aloft, bawling, "I surrender, don't shoot! I'm not American, I'm British! Christ, I ain't even in uniform, blast you!" And if anyone had shown the least inclination to say, "Hold on, Lakotas, let's hear what he has to say," I might have checked and hoped. But all I got was a whizzing of arrows and balls as I tore through the gap. Rode down two braves who sprang to bar my path, cut out and missed a mounted fellow with a club. And then I was thundering down the right side of the gully towards the group on their sorrels. And they weren't there. Nothing but bloody Indians hacking and stabbing and snatching at riderless beasts. I tried to swerve, aware of a mounted lancer coming up on my flank, a painted face beneath a buffalo helmet. He veered in behind me. I screamed as in imagination I felt the steel piercing my back. Hands were clutching at my legs, painted faces leaping at my pony's head. My saber was gone. An arrow zipped across the front of my coat. Something caught the pony a blow near my right knee. And then I was through the press, only a few Indians running across my front, when an arrow struck with a sickening thud into the pony's neck. As it reared, I went headlong, rolling down a little gully side and fetching up against a dead cavalryman with his body torn open, half disemboweled. I lay sprawled on my back as two of those screaming brutes came leaping over the bank. They collided with each other and went down, and behind them the buffalo cap lancer was sliding from his saddle, jumping over the other two, swinging up his hatchet. His left hand was at my throat. The frightful painted face was screaming a foot from mine. "Horn!" he yelled, and his hatchet flashed down into the ground beside my head. His breath was stinking against my face as he snarled, lie still, don't move, whatever happens." Up went his hatchet, and again it missed my face by a whisker, and his left hand must have been busy with the dead trooper's innards, for a bloody mess was thrust into my face, and then he had a knife in his hand. It flashed before my eyes. There was a blinding pain on top of my skull, but I was too choked with horror, physical horror, to scream. And then he was on his feet, yelling exultantly, "Another of them! Kai! Go find your own Lakotas!" I didn't see this, blinded with pain and human awful as I was, but I heard it. I lay frozen while they snarled at each other. There was blood running into my eyes. My scalp was a fire of agony. Oh, I knew what had been done to me, all right, but why hadn't he killed me? "Just lie still. I'm robbing your corpse," growled a voice close to my ear, and his hands were delving into my pockets, tearing at my coat, dragging my shirt half over my bloodied face. The laundry would certainly refuse my linen after today. Who the hell was he? I wanted to shriek with pain and fear, but had just enough wit not to. "Easy does it," muttered the voice. "Scalping ain't fatal, it's just a nick. Have you any other wound? If you haven't, and understand what I'm saying, move the little finger off your right hand the least bit. Good. And don't move another muscle. There are 6 of 'em within 20 yards, and I'm just muttering curses to myself, but if you start thrashing about, they may be curious. Lie still, lie still." I lay still. By God, I lay still, with my head splitting, while he emptied my pockets and suddenly shouted, "Get away, you minicon shoe thief! This one's mine!" "That's not a pony soldier," snarled another voice. "What's that shining thing you've got?" "Something too good for you, scabby head," cries my boy. "This is a white man's clicky thing. See, it has a little splinter that moves round. Oh, you can have it if you like, but I'll keep his dollars." "It's alive, the clicky thing," cries the other. "See, it does move. Hinte, hiya, what do I want with it? Give me the dollars, eh, brule? Go on!"
I heard a jingle of coins and someone shuffling away, and all around me, through the waves of pain and fear, I could hear a ceaseless chorus of groans and screams and exultant yells, and one awful, bubbling, high-pitched shriek of agony. Some poor bastard hadn't been killed outright. Occasional shots, wailing voices raised in chants, and all about my head, flies buzzing, crawling on my head. I was matted with blood and stifling with filth, and the sun's heat was unbearable. But I lay still. "He's gone," growled my unseen preserver. "Didn't want your watch. Lie still, you fool." For I had jerked automatically, as it dawned on me. To the Minneconjou he'd spoken Siouan, but all the words he'd addressed to me had been in English. Good English, too, with a soft, husky American accent. There it was again. "Keep lying still. I'm going to sit up on the bank above you and sing a song of triumph for the destruction of all the pony soldiers, do you see? Right, there's no one here but us chickens at present, but it won't get dark for another 4 hours, I guess. Then we'll get you away. Can you play possum that long? Move your pinky if you can. That's the ticket. Now take it easy." I was past wondering. I didn't care. I was alive with a friend close by, whoever he might be. For the rest, I still hadn't taken in the horror of it. Half a regiment of U.S. cavalry had been massacred, wiped out in barely a quarter of an hour. Custer was dead. They were all dead, except me. "Don't go to sleep," said the voice, "and don't get delirious or I'll dot you a good one. Right, listen to this." And he began to chant in Siouan about how he had slain 6 pony soldiers that day, including a Washechuska English soldier chief with a watch from Bond Street, which was still going and the time was 5:10, which beggared imagination, if you like. Then he went on about what a great warrior he was, and how many times he'd counted coup, and I lay there with the flies eating me alive. Never mind, worse things can happen. I must have slept, in spite of his instruction, or more likely it was a long faint, for suddenly I was cold, and an arm was round my shoulders, easing me up, and water was being dashed in my face, and the cloth was sponging away the caked blood. A bowl was held to my parched mouth, and the American voice was whispering, "Gently now, a sip at a time, good. Now lie still a while till I get you smartened up." I gulped it down, ice cold, and managed to get my gummed eyelids opened. It was dusk, with stars beginning to show and a chill wind blowing. Beside me knelt the fellow in the buffalo helmet, a fearsome sight, and no prettier when he grinned, which he did when I croaked for information who he might be. "Let's say a resurrectionist. Can you walk? All right, I'll carry you a piece, but then you'll have to sit a pony. First of all, let's get you looking like one of the winning team." He dragged off my clothes and somehow got me into a buckskin shirt and leggings. My head was aching, fit to split, and wasn't improved when he insisted on putting his buffalo cap on it. In the dim light, I saw his long hair hung to his shoulders and his face was bright with paint. American or half-breed, he'd taken pains with his makeup. "Now, listen close," says he. "There are still braves and women around collecting the dead." Sure enough, the evening was being broken by the high-pitched keening of the death songs. Against the night sky I could see figures moving to and fro, and there were pinpoints of torchlight all over the slope. "All right, we're going downstream to a ford farther along. That way we can skirt the village, and I'll get you to a place where you can lie up a spell. Hoo-hey, let's go." I could just stumble with him holding me. Then there was a pony, and he was helping me up. I reeled in the seat with his arm about me, but although my head was bursting with pain, I managed to balance, just. Then we moved slowly forward through the gathering night, down a slope and under cottonwoods. I could hear the river bubbling near, but I was like a man in a dream. Time meant nothing, and I was only now and then aware that I was still astride a pony, that it was splashing through water, that we were mounting a slope. Twice I was falling from my seat when he caught me and held me upright. How long we rode, I can't tell. I remember a moon in the sky and a hand on my shoulder, and then I know I was lying down and a deep voice was speaking in Siouan from very far away.
Put the crease on his head, and if it becomes angry, send for me. No one will come, but if they do and they are of our people, tell them he is to stay here. Tell them that this is my word. Tell them the one who catches has spoken.
Chapter 21, the last chapter. When you're past the 50 mark, you don't mend as quickly as you used to. For one thing, you don't want to. Where once on a day you couldn't wait to be off your sick bed and rampaging about, you're now content to lie still and let any handy ministering angels do their stuff. When I was a brat of a boy, I went through hot hell in Afghanistan, had a fort collapse on me, and broke my thigh. And a few weeks later, I was fit enough to gallop an Afghan wench with my leg in a splint and old Avitabile egging me on, and get beastly drunk afterwards. Not at 53. If they'd paraded the Folie Bergère past me a month after Little Bighorn, I'd have asked for bread and milk instead, and damn little of that in case it overexcited me. I was in a delirium for the best part of a fortnight, they tell me, and near carried off by what sounds to have been pneumonia. When I came to, I was weak as a rat, and only able to move sufficiently to gulp down small mouthfuls of blood soup, which is capital stuff for a convalescent, but hard to come by unless you have a supply of fresh buffalo meat to hand. Apparently my hosts did, or I should say host, for there was only one of him most of the time. He was a breed called Joe Brightdeer, so he told me, and that was about all I could get out of him, at least where my miraculous rescue was concerned. Who the man was who'd pretended to kill me and had genuinely scalped me, although pretty superficially, presumably to add verisimilitude for the benefit of Sioux bystanders, and had brought me here, wherever here was, he simply would not say, except that it hadn't been him. I pestered him about the last thing I remembered, asking who the one who catches might be, and he said that the one who catches had seen me and would come again, possibly. In the meantime, I could shut up and have some more blood soup.